Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. A young boy and his father cross the border from their South Texas home every other Saturday. They have breakfast at their favorite place. They visit their family's jewelry shop where the adults chat it up and the kids kick around a soccer ball outside. They pick up a few groceries, water, clothes, shoes, comic books, and prescriptions. At the end of their day in El Otro Lado, on the other side, they pull to the side of the international bridge and pass along the items they purchased to a group of asylum seekers who they've befriended on their travels back and forth in the last several months. This is the story told in the picture book, My Two Border Towns. David Bowles wrote the book based on his own experiences living on the South Texas border. Erika Mesa based her illustrations on her memories living on the California-Mexico border. This is Bowles' first picture book. He's an associate professor in the Department of Literatures and Cultural Studies at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. He's written over a dozen award-winning titles, including My Two Border Towns. Mesa is a children's illustrator and author born in Mexico and living in the UK. She works in ink, gouache, and watercolor, all of which bring to life the story of the unnamed boy and his father in My Two Border Towns. Bowles talks about the real-life inspiration and message behind his book.
It was inspired by the biweekly trips that my wife and I make to Nuevo Progreso on the other side of the border, or to Rio Bravo, so two towns that are right across the border from where we live. Trips that we've been taking for decades, usually with our children, but now that they're all grown up, the trips are just to the two of us. And one of the things we began to notice in about 2017 was that kind of camped along the pedestrian walkway were these entire families. And we wondering what was going on or where they were from, started striking at conversations. And we learned that many of them were from Central America or from the Caribbean. And there was one particular family from Cuba that we kind of got to know pretty well. And we began to go a little more often and to take them water and food and other kind of supplies and go fill their prescriptions for them. The problem that they were experiencing is that the former president had put into place a checkpoint like halfway across the bridge so that people who were seeking asylum couldn't step foot on U.S. soil, which according to international law means that they automatically are eligible to request asylum, right, if they step foot on U.S. soil. So keeping them from even doing that kind of backed up the system and had them waiting kind of anxiously in Mexico. And they didn't want to leave the bridge. They didn't want to lose their opportunity to get an appointment to have their asylum petition heard. I just really felt bad for these families that were fleeing from violence and other horrible things in their countries and trying to find refuge and were being stuck in this limbo for sometime months and months on end. And I began to imagine what it would have been like to meet these families with my son, the youngest, who is like this really compassionate young man. He's now 21 at the time he was a teenager. So I just kind of in my mind put together these different things, like my trips to Reynosa when I was growing up in McAllen with my dad to visit family and friends, and the same things that I would do with my son, you know, several decades later, and then placing those experiences on top of this kind of crisis and just imagining what it must feel like to be a kid from the Rio Grande Valley or from any border place, any border town, who goes to the other side, to the other part of his transnational community, to just enjoy the wonderful things that transnational communities offer, you know, like El Paso Juarez or San Diego, Tijuana, whatever it happens to be, only to be confronted by the fact that there are people that don't have that privilege that he does. And like, what does a young boy do with that? How does he handle the compassion he feels towards the people who don't have the privilege? And I don't think that children, you know, of 4, 5, 6 years of age are too young to kind of begin to face that, because especially if they live on the border, they're going to have to face it at some point. And I thought that a picture book would be a really interesting way for people outside of the border to come at this issue in a non-political way, in a humanitarian way, in a cultural and geographically centric way.
And I also think that this book also, and this is what I've talked about a lot on this program before, it it needs to help people refocus how they see the border, because in these last 5-6 years, when President Trump came into office, the border became one of his primary targets. And so it was painted in a particularly dark and ominous light. And those of us from the border, you're from the border, I'm from the border, I'm from El Paso, we know it as something completely different. And so in telling these stories, you're helping to reshape the narrative of what it is like to live there and to cross back and forth in that very unified culture between the two nations.
Absolutely. And that was really important to Erica and to me, that we show the joy, the beautifulness, the everyday humanity of living in a transnational community, which, as you say, both the former president and our present governor depict in like really, really negative, scary ways. Like it's some kind of post-apocalyptic landscape, like ripped out of a Mad Max film or something, you know, and it's not at all. I mean, I, you know, regularly go back and forth across the border and have my entire life. I'm 52 and it is just a normal place with normal people living normal lives. And it would be really nice if people could see that. And, you know, I also wanted to kind of make points about self-sustainability, the fact that we have networks in place to take care of people who come to our community and who need our aid. We don't really need people who have a political drum to beat to interfere with what we can do locally to protect our people. And so, I mean, that was something else I kind of wanted to insert subtly, but surely.
Well, yeah, the message here, I think, is very subtle. You are painting this beautiful picture of life on the border, how the two cities are very similar. Even in the back of the book, it says this town's a twin of the one where I live. I want to bring you into the conversation, Erica. I recognized quite a few images from the times when I remember I used to cross into Juarez regularly with my family. Haven't been there in several years, but you paint so many images there that are so familiar to people when they're crossing back and forth. I don't know if you had any conversations with David when you were illustrating his words or how your collaborative process was, but I'm curious, what was your inspiration when you were painting these scenes of both the U.S. side and the Mexican side?
One of my main concerns was that I knew that he was writing it from a completely different perspective of the border that I lived in. I'm from the San Diego-Tijuana border, and I knew that David was based in Texas and that he would be thinking of the Texas side of the border. And I'd been there when I was little, when I was not necessarily paying attention to all of the details. So I was very keen on finding out what was the common ground that we had in terms of the border, but also to try and define for myself what was the, shall we say, the uniqueness, visually speaking, of the border in my own terms of my own personal journey. The family was from the center of Mexico, from Mexico City. You know, we were traveling all over the place, moving everywhere. And then I moved to the border when I was 16. It's the one place where I live the most. So it, technically, like, I consider it my home, but I also experienced that sense of arriving and getting a sense of familiarity, but also of complete uniqueness, because it's kind of like an entity of its own. It's got its own life, its own qualities, its own landscape. So I was very keen on trying to define something that would identify only the border, not just Mexico in general, you know, so that you would open it and not think, well, that could be Oaxaca or Michoacán or Zacatecas, like to see it and to immediately feel that binational kind of blend, but also to try and bring all of the border lands into a kind of, shall we say, generic border book, so that no matter where you were in that line, you would still feel like it's something familiar and close to home. So all that ended up happening is that I drew loads and tried to pay attention to those details, and it ended up being very apparent that it was all in the small winks, in the small details, which is why it ended up being so populated with Easter eggs. So it's all in the grammatical construction of a Spanish sign written with the English grammar.
Restaurant instead of restaurant. I remember
that. Or having an exclamation in Spanish with only the closing exclamation point, as opposed to having the opening one as well. They're very, very small details, but they're the kind of stuff that kind of makes you feel like you're in the border. Having English signs in the Mexican side or Spanish signs in the American side, to have small kind of rundown American things in the US, like a school bus that is clearly recognizably from the US, but it's actually being used as a public transportation system in the Mexican side.
Right.
You know, these kind of small sort of irregularities, I think, are what kind of makes the border the border. So I just ended up kind of making peace with the fact that I was having to draw loads, that it wasn't going to be a very kind of sparse background picture book.
Yeah, I love when we do school visits, sometimes Erika will show her notebooks where she like was building up this like vocabulary of border architecture and like just drawing on pages like a storefront or a person, a character, whatever. And she just created this, I guess, like glossary of visual things that then when she creates like a city street, she's able to drop those things in ways that both harmonize, but also have that like cacophony that she's suggesting, that cultural cacophony that's so difficult to put your finger on, but like when you see it, you know you're on the border. And so like the overall cumulative effect is anybody who's been in border town anywhere along the river or the rest of the border between Mexico and the US will go, yep, that feels authentic to me.
David Bowles is the author of the picture book, My Two Border Towns. The book is illustrated by Erika Mesa. When we come back, Mexico-born illustrator Erika Mesa lived for a while on the border and drew from those experiences to create a landscape familiar to many fronterizos.
So yeah, it was about finding all of those similarities, but also those differences between the two communities to try and make sure that both seem distinct and with a character of their own.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Children's picture books often have a special way of bringing grown-up themes down to a child's level without sacrificing the meaning. They tackle topics that have recently drawn fire by some conservative pundits: racism, LGBTQ issues, or immigration. David Bowles and illustrator Erika Mesa don't shy away from their humanitarian message in support of asylum seekers in the picture book My Two Border Towns. Mesa took on the task of illustrating the similarities and differences of the borderlands. She says it's an area where the landscape and the language blur the closer one gets to the actual dividing line.
David and I talked about how when you're a kid and you fall asleep on the car, you wake up and just with a single glance out the window, you know which side of the border you're on, simply because the streets will be wonky, mm-hmm. or the houses will be kind of badly finished, or the cables will be showing on the lamppost, and so you'll go, all right, okay, so I'm in Mexico then. Or you'll be in the US side and you'll have this very kind of classically 50s storefronts. And then you'll know straight away that, yeah, you've already crossed and you can finally start to wake up. So, yeah, it was about finding all of those similarities, but also those differences between the two communities to try and make sure that both seem distinct and with a character of their own. It was quite a, I don't want to brag and be like, oh, thank God they grabbed an artist from the border. But I think it would have been something very difficult for someone who had never been there to kind of put their finger on.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons that Erika was like the only choice. And it was really funny because both the editor and I, and she's like, so what illustrators you have in mind? And I was like, well, I don't know if you know her work, but I was thinking about Erika Mesa. And she's like, oh my God, I was thinking about her too. And we're like, okay.
Well, people might be intrigued, David, to know that you do work a lot with illustrators and you do also write for younger readers. But I was saying that this book is a departure because it really is, you call it a picture book. I think some people will call it a children's book, even though I think children and adults would really get a lot out of this book, like you were saying, Erika. I mean, there's a lot of little Easter eggs. You can just spend minutes upon minutes just looking at each page. But David, tell us about why this is a departure from some of your books. People who might not be familiar with some of your works.
I usually write books that are probably a little more speculative, I guess, fantasy, science fiction, things like that. I was originally best known for my Goddess of Twins series, the first book of which got a Puro Bel Pre author honor in 2016. And it's like a fantasy series along the lines of Percy Jackson or something like that, but with Mexican-American kids from the border grappling with Aztec and Maya deities and monsters and stuff like that. And I write a lot of work that is rooted in indigenous tradition, a lot of like retellings of Nahua, Aztec mythology, Maya sacred stories, and so forth. A book called Feathered Serpent, Dark Heart of Sky, Myths of Mexico, which is kind of a tapestry of different indigenous stories from before the Spanish invasion. And that's being adapted into graphic novels that are illustrated by my daughter, Charlene. And I've got a series called Clockwork Curandera, which is like a steampunk alternate universe series that's set in the 19th century, where steampunk technology, like steam-driven robots and things like that, exist alongside mestizo and indigenous magic. So there's like lechuzas and robots, right? So it's at the same time, I'm probably best known for my book, They Call Me Güero, the sequel of which is coming out in September. They Call Her Fregona. And those are novels in verse, middle grade novels in verse, about a boy in middle school who is also from the border, a light-skinned kid who discovers poetry as a way to like grapple with the problems in his life, the bullies, the social unrest, and the bad attitudes about the border, but also as a way to celebrate his identity and celebrate his roots and so forth. So while my work tends toward the speculative, I also have things that are just a little more like just realistic. And in fact, it was They Call Me Güero, which was kind of the inspiration for my two border towns in a way, because the very first poem in the book, Border Kid, which was initially published in an anthology edited by Sylvia Vardell and Janet Wong, that was published right after Trump's election as a way to help teachers give kids tools to grapple with the anxiety they were feeling about what would happen to their families, kids from communities of color, Muslim kids, and so forth. And then it got reprinted in the Journal of Children's Literature, and I read it when I was inducted into the Texas Institute of Letters. That was the thing that turned into They Call Me Güero, because I was offered a book deal that very day that I was inducted into the Institute of Letters on the basis of one poem alone. And that poem that then served also as a template for this book. And thinking, when I was beginning to contemplate telling a story about a kid confronted with asylum seekers and refugees in the midst of his transnational community, I thought to myself, okay, where do I begin? And I reread Border Kid, which is about a kid going across the border with his dad every other weekend or whatever, and like being confronted by the border wall. I was like, this is a great template. If I take this and age it down and expand it, I'll have a good starting point for this book for young readers. And so, yeah, in that way, it's a departure, because it's focused on real world problems and people's inability to do a whole lot other than just care. In speculative fiction, I can give my young protagonists magical powers or science fiction tools that they can use to grapple with their problems. But when you write about the real world, stripped bare of those things, you're faced with the really kind of sobering reality that one individual can't change things, that you have to work as a community. And even as a community, it's an uphill battle. And the best you can do is to care for one another and to ease each other's pain while you're hoping that your lives become a beacon that will change the minds of people that have power. It's a tough thing. It's a really tough thing to write about. It's why it's so much more satisfying to write speculative fiction, because you could like make all kinds of magical things happen and zap the bad guys and they disappear. In the real world, you have to find ways to govern alongside them, because when half of your society wants you gone, what do you do?
Well, something you said, David, and I'll ask the same question of you, Erika, if you can maybe answer after David, but something that you mentioned about you having been offered a book deal, I remember a few years ago, there was a big hullabaloo over publishers not publishing the works of writers of color. Since then, David, have you seen a change in the publishing industry?
There are some glacial, gradual changes happening. I was one of the co-founders of Dignidad Literaria, and we went, you know, in February 2019 to New York City to sit down with the publishers at Macmillan, specifically their Flatiron imprint, but the entire company, to kind of hold their feet to the fire about the lack of Latinx representation, both in the books they were acquiring and in their editorial staff. And, you know, after a two-hour meeting that day, we did get them to make some concessions to agree to a plan to improve Latinx representation. And those things are happening. But obviously, the pandemic complicated things. And even more, it gave publishers an excuse to not implement some of the more difficult things because they were in the midst of a pandemic and having to telecommute, blah, 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 blah. But there has been some, like I say, just gradual improvement. It's not the kind of like sea change that I would like to see, where we're dismantling some of the more oppressive parts of the publishing world. I published with several of the big five. They are doing their due diligence. I think about Penguin, where this book was published, and where They Call Me Güero and The Color Fregona are coming out from, the Coquila imprint. Because of Coquila and other imprints, and just like a general dedication to the notion of diversifying their collection and being truly representative of the demographics of the country, you know, I see a lot of great things happening, but it doesn't happen as fast as it needs to happen. But that's the way corporations are, which is why I like to work alongside Joaquin Castro, representative of Texas, in the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, and other government organisms that will help to prod these corporate entities in the right direction, because it's tougher to do for nonprofits and independent activist organizations to compel them to make the changes they need. It's so much better when you have the support of the government. And so, I mean, we're pulling together and seeing this really, really slow change. And hopefully we can just keep that momentum going, and it will build and build and build. I'd like to see, frankly, and this is something that I think a lot of authors might be hesitant to say when they're published by the big five, but I'd like to see monopoly breaking things happen. I'd like to see antitrust legislation put into place. I really think that big publishing and Hollywood, they've all gotten too big. It's too much power being consolidated in the hands of single corporations. And it's deleterious in lots of ways to art, to society, to a lot of things. And so, yeah, I mean, short answer, I'd like to see like significant real change that would cause probably some pain and cost a lot of money. But I'm also not holding my breath.
Erika?
Yeah, I'm in a funny situation myself, in that I'm based in the UK. So I get to see kind of what's going on in terms of publishing as a business and the different conversations that run through it. Be it diversity, be it representation, be it whatever topic you want to discuss. I get to see kind of both sides of the Atlantic. I get to basically just sit quietly and look at all of the fronts. And this is essentially a conversation that has been mirrored on both sides of the Atlantic. But as far as I'm concerned, for me, the dream would be not necessarily, you know, monopolies breaking apart, although I can see the benefit of that. And frankly, I agree, David. I'd love to be able to not have to have this conversation. I know it's not going to happen probably in my lifetime. I wish it did. But I wish that it was just normal to simply assume that a character could be any person. Meaning to say, at the moment, we've got the CLPE here in the UK has got this report they're releasing every single year in terms of the percentages of representation that you've got in books. They're not necessarily just talking about the authors and who is getting to say these stories. They're also talking about the kind of stories that are being told. Although it has been rising slightly, you still have got a situation where it's easier to publish a book about animals than to publish a book with a person of minority in the main cover or in the main role. This, essentially, these kind of narratives or these kind of stereotypes keep getting, they're perpetuated essentially. And it is a business after all, and it is, there is a money element to the whole thing. But every single time that there's a book that breaks that barrier and that does well with prices or sells well or does great with the public and, you know, becomes really, really popular, it kind of becomes the book. So I'm very afraid, for instance, of our book becoming the border picture book. It looks like it won't be the case. And thankfully, there are plenty of other people working on really, really good stuff. But it becomes very easy to kind of be like, right, okay, we've covered this subject. We don't need any more stories from this particular angle. So as far as I'm concerned, I think it would be brilliant if we actually got to the point where this whole conversation about who's writing the stories and who's actually being the main characters in the book, the conversation kind of became irrelevant just because it's kind of like, of course, it can be anyone. Having said that, at the moment, I think that whatever little progress had been done, we are currently in the receding wave. We are currently in the response to however many steps we could have taken towards that goal. And everything that is being experienced right now in terms of censorship and in terms of perhaps a lack of interest in maybe taking chances with certain creators or with certain stories, I think right now is the time to just kind of dig in and keep going at it. Because otherwise that whole movement that got started before the pandemic is probably going to lose whatever ground was able to cover it.
I think this is a good point. There was a graph that I saw on Twitter the other day about when you take a look at the books that have been banned, the identity of the author and of the protagonist, whatever, and the vast majority of them have authors of color or protagonists from communities of color. And then, of course, there are other things, you know, whether they're queer or disabled. It's really very stark that all these books that are being banned because of the identities of the protagonist and the authors. You know, just really, really scary. And there was another great Twitter thread that I reshared and kind of like expounded on the other day. This notion that we're not just writing anymore for the children from our communities right now, those of us who are from these like marginalized or racialized communities, but we're also writing for the children of who knows how far into the future, because it is true. We are in this receding wave, this kind of lull. It really feels like the direction we're going will set us back. Like the 10 years of progress that we've made may be truncated. Like we may lose a good 5 years of those 10 years of progress, if not more, if things continue to go the way they are. I mean, we'll see. We'll see after these midterm elections, frankly, in the U.S. I think the results of those are going to tell authors who write these kinds of books, you know, what they can expect coming forward. Because if the forces who would silence us, you know, gain control and get their way, that's their agenda. They don't want anything out there that would undercut the particular message that they want to transmit to children.
Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much, David Bowles, Erika Mesa, for talking to us on Fronteras today. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Writer David Bowles is an associate professor in the Department of Literatures and Cultural Studies at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley. He serves on the governing council of the Texas Institute of Letters. Bowles has written over a dozen award-winning titles, including They Call Me Güero and the forthcoming They Call Her Fregona. Bowles and illustrator and author Erika Mesa are the creators of the picture book My Two Border Towns, a recent recipient of the Tomas Rivera Children's Book Award. The book is also available in Spanish. Bowles is also co-founder of the hashtag and activist movement Dignidad Literaria, which negotiates for greater Latino representation in publishing. And Bowles will be in San Antonio this month for the 10th San Antonio Book Festival, May 21st. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show online at tpr.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Marian Navarro. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Bree Kirkham. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.